from HanselMinutes.com. It's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 312, recorded live Thursday, April 5th, 2012. Support for Hansel Minutes is provided by Telerik, offering the best in developer tools and support. Online at www.telerik.com. In this episode, Scott talks with Phil Hack about his opinions on the ASP.NET MVC open source announcement.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we've got Phil Hack, former Microsoftie, former PM for ASP.NET MVC, now a guy who works at GitHub. Hey, Phil, how's it going?
Good. How you doing, Scott?
I'm very well. GitHub, open source. You're continuing the tradition, the proud Hack family tradition of open source software.
That is correct.
Were you pretty happy when we finally got that open source stuff done and we released MVC, Web API, and Razor as real open source with contributions last week?
So it was already, most of it was already real open source, but yes, I was happy that it finally came out as open and collaborative, in the words of Miguel de Caza, meaning that that Microsoft is accepting takebacks. As you know, that's something that we've been working on for a very long time, and a lot of the infrastructure was already ready before I left, but, you know, there were some last little pieces that were in place, so I've had to keep my mouth shut for the last several months, and it's been very, very hard.
You were kind to correct me there, but does that bug you when people say that? I mean, MVC came out, what was it, like 4 years ago as open source? But I use the term just now, real open source, because sometimes I juxtapose source opened and open source. I mean, it wasn't reference source. It was really MSPL open source. But it wasn't like a lot of people were forking it and building their own versions, were they?
No, but they had the right to. And I think that's the important thing. I put most of my thoughts on this in a blog post, or two blog posts, actually. And the thing is that if you look at all the language of the original open source pioneers, Richard Stallman and Cathedral guy, I'm blanking on his name, if you look at all their writings, or even guys like Miguel, who's very well regarded in the open source community, all the wording they use is talking about freedom. And it's about the freedom to use the software in a way you see fit and the freedom to change the software for your needs. And I think this is something that I've seen a lot more in like other open source communities, non-.NET communities, where a lot of people have shallow forks of projects that they use. And by shallow forks, I mean where they'll take a project and they'll just tweak a little bit. And I think part of the reason I'm being exposed to this more is at GitHub. I'm looking at the work I'm doing as well as the work other people do, and we make heavy use of submodules. And if you're not familiar with Git, submodules is a way that you can have your Git repository reference some external repository. And what we'll do is, for example, if we're using a library like libgit2-sharp, but we have our own modifications we want to keep in our project, we'll create a fork of libgit2, make a few tweaks, and then have a submodule pointing to our fork so that when I get my project, I have this, I get my version of libgit2. So we actually end up making a lot of these shallow forks. And it turns out that in many of these cases with shallow forks, you actually don't really, you know, we would love our changes to make it back into the main one, but we sort of don't care because some of the changes are very specific to our needs and probably won't ever make it back. But using a distributed version control like Git makes it really easy for us to just pull the upstream or like the original changes into our fork and into the code that we're working on. And the thing is that you could have a project that's completely, has takebacks, but doesn't have an open source license. And now you're really playing with fire because, you know, they at any time, and several people have written me to say that this has happened to them. They've seen this happen where, you know, the company was basically doing what's the equivalent of crowdsourcing, And then they closed off and said, okay, well, this is all our IP and you can no longer make variations of this, but you can continue to contribute to our work. And that's sort of like the worst of all cases, right? Because you've just been suckered. So while, you know, and the thing is that, like, when I, while I say this, it's important to me that the that we understand why the license is important and why it's, why I harp on this. But at the same time, that doesn't mean that I don't prefer, vastly prefer takebacks in an open and collaborative development. In fact, I mean, that's what I was pushing for very early on. And, I even, when we first released MVC under the MSPL, I had a little blurb in there saying, look, you know, we're taking baby steps and, you know, maybe if we fast forward a few years, we'll be taking contributions. And so, you know, I didn't write that because I could predict the future. I wrote that because that was the future I was trying to create.
When you say the word shallow fork, how is that different from the term private build? Are those the same things? Because, I mean, I before distributed version control systems, I had private builds of Log4Net back when there were bugs and no one was listening, and I would fix them, and then we would just kind of ship our own private build. Juxtapose that
that's
shallow fork,
more or less. That's more or less the same thing. It's not like you're, I think the distinction is when people hear the, traditionally when you hear the term fork, you think, oh, these guys are breaking off of the main project and trying to create their own big project. But with the advent of distributed version control, forks has become turned from sort of this like, negative term to a very positive term. Oh, what that means is that you're just, you know, maintaining some tweaks for yourself and, you know, you're fine to share it with the world, but you're not making a statement that I'm breaking from the main project, right? You're still kind of tied to the main project. And I think that's the connotation.
So then what's the opposite of that? Is like an aggressive fork? Is the like, screw you, we're taking this code and we're going our own direction?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I don't know if there's, I haven't heard that term, but that sounds about right.
All right, we'll make that a term now, aggressive forking.
Aggressive forking. Yeah, yeah.
Do you? A number of people were saying that they didn't like that ASP.NET web forms was not open sourced, and that we didn't go like deeper into the GAC, into the global assembly cache. And I wrote up why we didn't do that, but I was curious what you thought about that.
You know, honestly, I think it's inevitable that that should happen, and maybe will happen, but it's a much more tortuous and difficult battle. At a recent talk, I talked about, I gave a brief blurb about the two Microsofts. And so anywhere where those two worlds collide becomes very difficult to make it open. So as you probably, I didn't actually read your blog post about why WebForms is an open source, but my guess is you wrote that, well, it's part of Windows. And once it's part of Windows, it's under Sinofsky's org, and that makes it very difficult to, because you need his buy-off to make that open source. So it's not something that's just completely within the power of, you know, Guthrie to say, wave his magic wand and say, it's now open source, you know?
That wasn't actually why. It was more kind of the logistics of the fact that it's in the GAC, and if you go and ship it, then you've got to figure out how to ship a private build of something that ships with Windows. It was more the actual build.
Oh, so you went technical, and I'm here talking political because I'm outside.
No, I mean, so there's a couple of different things that you've touched on. First, it was just literally logistically shipping stuff that was in the GAC was complicated, and you know how that works. It's a mess. As far as the political stuff, I'm surprised. I mean, like, I realize that
around to that, it's just that they're costlier and they'll take longer. You could ship a shim of system web in the GAC, but then can dynamically load the open source version that's outside the GAC that's, mm-hmm. that's shipped as an open source product, right? Like, and that's actually, you know, before I left, that's the kind of thing we often talked about. You know, we've gone, I remember Scott Hunter, your boss and my former boss, he and I used to joke about wanting to build ASP2.NET and basically rewrite the whole thing. And we actually, not me and him, but like the team actually went through iterations where we kind of looked at, well, could we make what we have today a little more componentized or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. And so it turns out to be a pretty big task. So yeah, I mean, I think it's possible, but not in the timeline that we were, you know, not in the same timeline that it would take to make MVC, which was already out of band, meaning that it was shipped as a separate bin deployable assembly. But I mean, I think in the long run, it's possible to make most of it open source. And, you know, I would encourage, you know, Microsoft to look at that. But at the same time, you know, you have to look at cost benefits and audience, right? Mm-hmm. Like, are there really that many web form developers who are going to get involved with the contribution? I think, correct me if I'm wrong, was routing also kept in, not released as open source? Because that would be the one component that I would imagine would be possible to extricate it mm-hmm. from the core framework and make that open source.
Yeah, I don't think routing was, because routing was originally system.web.mvc.routing and then moved upstream and became system.web.routing and now has been baked into .NET since 3.5 SP1.
Yeah, that's well. So 3.5 SP1, it was actually still a separate DLL, but it was shipped as part of the framework and separately. So we did mm-hmm. some crazy stuff there. But in ASP.NET 4, we actually type forwarded all the types back into system.web.
Okay, so it's in system.web now, not in its own DLL.
So it's in system.web, so basically the gates of no escape.
Now, I'm surprised that you said that you thought that, I think, I'm trying to say, there's a little bit of an artificial distinction there. You juxtaposed Windows and Scott's org, but as if that they're somehow against each other. But Sanofsky's org, while different, is very open. I mean, if you look at their blogs and stuff, I mean, it's not like Ubuntu open, but I mean, the Building Windows 8 blog, they're pretty much like, here are the metrics, here are the charts, here are why we make these decisions. I mean, they're not giving us daily builds, us, the public, but it's more open than Windows 7 was. I'm surprised that you said that.
Oh, yeah. So when they're ready to talk about their development, they are open, right? But I mean, prior to that, it was a closed book. But I'm more talking about open source, meaning that there's a healthy fear over there of open source, or unhealthy, I should say. Just to give you one example, right? I mean, there were people who really wanted to just adopt jQuery for WinRT, right? You know, and maybe build WinRT as a jQuery plugin or some way of adopting jQuery, because jQuery is already written and it's the most popular JavaScript library out there. Instead, they wrote their own clone of jQuery that's specific to WinRT. So, I mean, it's different. But at the same time, you know, you kind of wonder, like, why not just adopt the what's out there, right? I mean, the good news is that, from what I understand, you can run jQuery in WinRT. So those who really want to run it will. But, I mean, it's just a different philosophy, right? So, like, whereas, let's look at MVC, where we just included jQuery in the project template. More recently, the MVC team decided to, and the web API team decided to adopt JSON.NET as their JSON serialization engine and over their own, because their own was insufficient.
Mm-hmm. But when you went and picked jQuery, did people complain and say, why didn't you pick MooTools, or why didn't you pick MochiKit, or why didn't you pick XYZ JavaScript library? Like, jQuery had like 92% of the market at that point. But people would probably say, well, that's not fair. You didn't pick my library.
You know, I didn't. In the case of jQuery, I think two things happened. One, jQuery was overwhelmingly the most popular. So the decision to choose it was obvious. And two, I think people were shocked that we're shipping third-party open source within a Microsoft product in the first place. So it took them time to recover from that shock to come around and ask those questions. So I actually didn't hear a lot of that with jQuery.
What do you do when there's one project already, when there's one project that is like the winner, like they're the most popular, but they're not necessarily the best?
Well, so that's an interesting question, because how do you define best, right? I mean, yeah, like I read this interesting article a long time ago about VHS and Beta, right? And they're saying, oh, well, Beta was Betamax. So, and they're saying Betamax is better. But then another person took a different tact on the question. And he said, well, let's look at the total product, right? We're not going to just say video, you could zero in on video quality and clearly one's the winner. But if you look at the total product, supposedly it took two Betamax tapes to fit one movie, whereas it would take one VHS to record the same movie. So if you were to record something and then leave, you know, go out and record a movie, you would get the whole movie, whereas it, you couldn't leave it if you were doing Betamax. So I haven't verified these claims, you know, myself, but this is, it was a well-regarded article. And so they're talking about, well, when you look at the total product, sometimes technical superiority in one specific area doesn't overweigh, you know, the benefits in all the other areas, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's, a lot of times, like when people will say, oh, well, this product's clearly better than that other one because it's faster. Well, that's not the only thing. Is it, usable? How's the API? You know, how's the documentation? How's the support team? You know, all these other factors go into choosing a product.
Is it, what do you guys do at GitHub when you decide if you're going to use an open source library? Have you been there now, what, a couple months, 3 months?
Mm-hmm.
And have you been involved in any decisions where you guys sucked in a library to use on the core site?
It happens so second naturally that, well,
well, you just like pick stuff willy-nilly? I mean, I'm sure that there must be some amount of, you can't just pick something. You're a big site. If you picked an AGPL library, that would be bad, right?
So you're talking about GitHub. So I haven't been involved in any discussions of like pulling in libraries on GitHub.com, right? So
okay. That,
and there's probably most of the libraries that have been chosen already. The products I've worked on, I mean, we've had cases where we've pulled in libraries, but we sort of just, I don't know. We didn't have
super casual. You're like, yeah, man, it kind of looks cool. Let's compile, see if
it works. We were using, just one example. We were using some REST library, and then we switched to REST Sharp recently because, you know, we know John Sheehan, and we've heard good things about it, right? And so we're trying it out, and it seems to be working for us, and it solves some problems. So we're going with it for the time being. We didn't spend a huge amount. I think, like, the thing is, we could have spent huge amounts of time, you know, doing all kinds of evaluations and get stuck in this analysis paralysis. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we want to ship a product. So we're looking at, like, you know, based on what we've heard and, you know, based on past experience, does this sound like this library is going to meet our needs? You know,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, we've heard people we trust say halfway decent. Other people have told us there's better ones out there. So, you know, we might look at those later, but right now it's met the needs that we have.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, our entire product is not going to, fail or succeed based on, you know, what REST library we chose.
Mm-hmm.
And by REST library, I mean for an HTTP client.
For the client.
Making
right?
REST calls, not on the server side.
What about like things that Microsoft does, like patent scrubs and making sure that people didn't copy-paste patented code directly into REST Sharp, as an example. Like, does GitHub do that kind of stuff? Or do you just, like, deal with it when you get sued?
Yeah, so I probably...
It's an honest question. I mean, I know... How big are you guys now? How many people?
60. 65.
Okay, so you're 60. So when I was working at Carillion in banking, before I was working at Microsoft, we were 300, 400 people. You know, and we would pick a library, we'd try to get it working, we'd kind of do the spike, then we'd go to the CTO, and then we'd say, we want to do this library. Then he would talk to the lawyers if it was a new license we hadn't seen before. And we had, like, preferred licenses we would use. Like, if it's Apache or BSD or MIT, those are good licenses that we wanted to use. And then they would, if we were going to actually ship it, we would go and, you know, like, get a company to go and look at the code and tell us if it was tainted or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, is that the difference between a 60-person company doing open source versus a 400-person company, or is that a difference versus an open source company like GitHub and a banking company like Carillion was?
Well, yeah, I think it's more the latter. And here's the thing: I can't speak to GitHub.com again because I haven't like been involved in.
Right. We're just talking about like the app you're working on,
yeah.
Which is not
yeah.
GitHub.com.
But here's the thing. Here's the big thing I learned at Microsoft about copyright and patent and licensing. It's all about managing risk, right? It's all about what is the benefit and what is the risk. It's not, you know, yes and no black and white decisions. None of them are, right? So what you have to look at is, okay, what's the risk that this is going to have, some bad code in it, some bad IP, right? And what is the cost to us if someone, if it does have that and someone calls it out, how easily is it to replace it, right? So, back at Microsoft, you look at something that's going to go into Windows. Well, that's a huge, if there's an injunction against Windows, that's a huge effect on Microsoft's business, right? Mm-hmm. So they go through, so that starts to justify some of the paranoia about open source and explains the, very diligent IP scrubs and patent scrubs that Microsoft goes through. When you look at something like deploying a website or, like the JavaScript code for a website, okay, well, maybe you have to turn off a feature for a little bit and you replace the library that you use. Or, shipping MVC. Okay, well, it sucks, but, we might have to reship MVC. And you realize that the cost of something, the risk goes down quite a bit. Mm-hmm. And so, in many respects, you're just looking at the risk. Like, okay, well, this library, John Sheehan says he's vetted most of the code, and what's the odds that anyone's going to, sue us for using Rest Sharp or whatever? It's probably very small. I mean, very, very small. In fact, you rarely hear cases like that where it's very rare for that to happen, I think, with these small open source projects.
Well, no one notices them, though, right? I mean, I'm just using this as an example.
The target is too small.
Yeah.
But Microsoft wears a giant target on its back. So I could see at Microsoft being a lot more careful. A banking institution, for example, has a lot riding on it. So I could see them being quite a bit more careful.
Yeah. I was involved maybe 10 or 15 years ago in a case. I was a witness, I was an expert witness. I wasn't involved on either side of the case. But basically, a company had copy-pasted some code literally directly out of a guy's PhD thesis, into their source, and then shipped it as a commercial product. And you would think that would not get noticed, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But it just kind of got noticed. Somebody scanned and found it, and then it was like, oh, wait a second, that's my stuff. And then that code had kind of multiplied, because that's kind of how DLLs, that's what happens, right? And you're like, oh, that's a useful DLL.
Yeah.
And then, and this is the kind of the chain of intellectual property. It's a lot like the chain of privacy that I talked about. I don't know if you saw the blog post where I was talking to a buddy of mine, and he showed me a really cool website that lets you do real-time chat and direct messaging for your users. So mm-hmm. if you don't have an inbox to talk to your users, but you do have an authentication system, you drop in this JavaScript file. And then suddenly you can see all of your users online, like in real time, and you can reach out and chat them. Like, you know how when like a chat pop-up just shows up, and it's all done with a single line of JavaScript. It's called Intercom. Have you seen this?
Mm-hmm.
It's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. It's amazing. But my buddy was like, yeah, you just have to implement this JavaScript, and then you add these variables at the top. And one of the variables was the user's email address. And I was like, well, wait a second. You just sent their email address to another domain off, via this JavaScript include. So what seemed like a really harmless thing turned into this kind of big deal. So we emailed the Intercom guys, and they were, of course, very organized, and they had privacy policies, and they explained the chain of privacy and everything like that. But it was that realization that, mm-hmm. wait a second, we just took a downstream third-party dependency and then started sending personal information over that. Not that that's bad, but that being aware of it is important. And I think the same thing.
I disagree. I think that's ridiculous that we're still sending email addresses back and, to sites to identify sites. I think Dare Obasanjo had a really great blog post where he talked about, a recent incident where Path was sending all your contacts' email addresses back to the Path server so that Path could identify these people. And you realize you don't need to send the email address. You just need to send something that can identify the email address. AKA a hash of the email address, right? Mm-hmm. And there's, this is, something that, Dare said that they do with Live, and it's a well-established practice. A lot of these startups kind of just like, oh, whatever, it's just people's data, and they don't treat it with the respect it deserves. And they really shouldn't be, you know, I'd be pissed if people were posting my email address all over the web. I mean, well, not me, but let's say my wife's email address or my kid's email address. I think mine is foregone conclusion that it's out there. But the point being that this is the kind of information that I don't think should be posted willy-nilly on sites. You should be able to send the hash back.
Mm-hmm. But wouldn't someone be able to then go and do like some kind of rainbow dictionary thing and figure out what your email is from your hash and just walk backwards?
Not if they're doing salted hashes properly, right? You know, you can do a site sends a token, you hash it with the a salt token, you hash it with that, and then that token is, you know, independent of everyone else. So it becomes much harder to do a rainbow hash attack.
Mm-hmm. Do you think, I was thinking actually about writing a blog post about this, the idea that the email address is like the new social security number. Like, some people care about it, some people don't, but ultimately it's a unique identifier that maybe you don't want published publicly.
Yeah, yeah. It's more like your phone number in a phone book, though, right? Because, like, you don't need my social security number to contact me, but you might need my email address. So, like, it's going to get out there, but you don't want everyone in the world necessarily having your phone number.
But if your email address is your login, then that's, you know, that's the two that's one of the two things I need to log into your, you know, your bank or whatever.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So it's a little of both.
Yeah, I mean, it's an identifier that you don't want to necessarily give away.
That's why we really need to push for two-factor authentication everywhere.
Have you turned on two-factor authentication on Facebook and on Gmail?
Yeah.
On both of them?
Yeah.
So you use the Gmail authentication application?
Yeah. So here's the irony, right? Two-factor authentication is about something you know and something you have, right? So you know your password, and you have, let's say, your phone, which, you know, Facebook and Gmail can either text you, or with Gmail, you can also have an app that has the ever-changing number. Mm-hmm. Kind of like, I don't know if you've ever, you probably, well, you were.
Yeah, it's like a key fob. We used to have a little funny-looking LED that would just give us a new number every,
Yeah, yeah. So the thing is, though, it's like if you lose your phone, chances are that someone who finds your phone has both things now, right? They have something you know and something you have. They have your both things. So it kind of defeats the purpose a little bit.
Well, how would they have my password if they got my phone?
Well, if you ever save your password for some small period of time, like in the site, right? Like, I mean, if you're not doing that, then, yeah, they don't have your password. They just have your phone.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose they have access to my email. I don't necessarily think they have my password. They have an open session.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But I mean, if they have your email, then they can pretty much get everything else, right?
Yeah, I guess for a period of time.
I'm not too worried about that because, like, I put a pin on my phone. But some people are advocating, well, you know, maybe we should really have separate key fobs so that, yeah, if you lose your fob, you don't necessarily have access to their session, right?
Yeah. Well, I think the argument would be that you can torch your phone within an hour of losing it if you need to.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Right. I mean, Windows Phone has that built in. It takes a minute to set it up on an iPhone. And if you have iPhone 5, they walk you through it when you start up. You need an app to do that on Android. But for the most part, you can remotely brick your phone.
Does that work over SMS or does that work over the internet?
I believe it works over the internet. So, I mean, if your phone is on, it can be torched remotely. I've left my phone in a park before and then logged in from my laptop, made the phone beep, and then walked around like sonar looking for the phone.
Well, what I'm wondering is, could you, if I found your phone, okay, we're probably getting way off topic here. If I found your phone and I'm behind a firewall and I block all incoming requests or I block outgoing requests to whatever service torches the phone, then how would you torch the phone, right? Unless it's sent by some other signal like SMS or whatever, in which case I would turn that off as well. Like, I'm wondering if there's workarounds to this or if they have some ingenious system that I just hadn't thought of.
Well, so let's pretend that they're not idiots, right? It's possible.
Yeah.
But assuming that for a second they're not idiots, let's say that, you know, evil guy picks up the phone and immediately airplane modes it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then that point, you've turned off the thing, right? But if you try to do it surgically and, like, turn off data access to this or that or turn off location services to this or that, find your phone might not work. But I'm assuming that there's a, you know, it's a little Unix machine, right? It's a little Mac OS 10 version, you know, iOS is all based on that. So there's daemons and stuff running in the background. One of them is listening for that. I think SMS mm-hmm. might be an assumption because people can turn off SMS. I'm sure that it's a data packet. But I discovered my iPhone is sending private information, not private information, but information all the time. If you go to like about general diagnostics, you can see all the crash dumps. The thing sends mm-hmm. a crash dump 3 or 4 times a day of whatever application borked.
Yeah.
Or if the phone crashes.
Well, that's the thing. So
panics.
Like if I was trying to live up to my name, last name here, but if I found your phone, I think this is not something that the average Joe needs to worry about, because if someone just finds a phone laying around, they probably don't have the sophistication to do all this. But if I was targeting your phone, Scott Hanselman's phone, I found it, turned mm-hmm. it in airplane mode, took it home, made sure I didn't connect to 3G, only connected to my router, made sure my router was blocking all outgoing requests.
I think it would be an incoming request.
Or incoming and outgoing, except for the domains that I care about. You know what I mean? Like, just tighten that stuff down, mm-hmm. then would I be able to, take advantage of your existing session?
That's a good question. I don't know. It depends on whether or not it is an incoming thing, or whether there's polling involved or whatever. But it'd be a risky thing to do, because it only takes like whatever the size of that packet is, 100 bytes or something, to torch your phone. So I think that'd be it'd be kind of like playing Operation. You know, you're going to eventually shock yourself.
Sounds like this could be another Handsome Minutes episode with someone who actually knows what they're talking about, not me.
We would never, ever have someone who actually knows what they're talking about on Handsome Minutes. And on that note, Phil Hack, our guest today on Handsome Minutes, thanks for hanging out.
Yeah, no problem.
This has been another episode, and we'll see you again next week.